In December, we lost James Brown, one of the most distinctive and influential musical figures of the last half century. He was a one-of-a-kind performer, which wasn't always something that worked in his favor. Today, rock historian Ed Ward goes back to the start of Brown's career to show us how James Brown came to be a star.
It began like this.
Please, 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 please.
Heaven only knows what King Records thought they were getting when they signed a Georgia vocal group called the Famous Flames and put them on their subsidiary label Federal, but this was it. Although the Please Don't Go backup was familiar enough, in fact, it had been taken from a 1952 record by the Orioles, it was the maniac up front who made all the difference. Nobody in January 1956 was singing like that, except in church. The Flames, aware that they might never get another chance, asked to record their big showstopper first. To make sure they had quality musicians, they borrowed Little Richard's band, the Upsetters. Richard didn't need them. He was in New Orleans, where great musicians grew on trees, recording Long Tall Sally that week. The record came out in March, despite the opinion of King's owner, Sid Nathan, that it was the worst piece of crap he'd ever heard. Ralph Bass, who oversaw the rhythm and blues division, walked into Nathan's office a few weeks later to tell him the record had gone top 10 on the rhythm and blues charts, even though it wasn't selling in the pop market. Nathan's reaction was understandable, though. He was probably expecting something more on the lines of another song they'd recorded that day. But once Please, Please, Please had triumphed, the best the record company could do was to copy it exactly. Worst of all, they repeated this formula for nearly 2 years. The Flames did well on the road, but only in the South. Their show contained a lot of blues numbers and climaxed with Please, 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 but James was getting restless. He thought a ballad would push him into nationwide fame, but the record company thought otherwise. Disgusted, he took his own money and recorded a demo of a song he wanted to do. Since none of the other records they'd put out had done anything, the company gave in and hired a crack band of New York studio musicians, including guitarist Kenny Burrell, tenor saxophonist Clifford Scott, and drummer Panama Francis, and gave it a shot.
Try me. Try me. Try me. And your love will always be true. Oh, I need you.
Try Me was James Brown's first number one R&B hit and even slid into the low 40s on the pop chart, ending 1958 for him on a triumphant note. He was able to hire his own band and suddenly found himself getting dates in places like Los Angeles. But although the follow-up, I Want You So Bad, was a minor R&B hit, 1959 slid by without another success. But he had something else up his sleeve, and on it, you can hear how a new style was emerging. Although the pop stations didn't go for that one, it did well enough that he dared to expose his brand new sound on the record he released in the summer of 1960, a total reworking of a song by the Five Royales. In it, you can hear the genesis of something revolutionary. Nobody was doing anything that sounded even remotely like this, and because he could, James Brown was on his way to becoming a huge star.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed a collection of James Brown's singles on Hippo Select. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. We want to remind you that Fresh Air is now available as a podcast on our website, freshair.npr.org.